This is not the prime time slot. I can take a hint from the conference organizers. There's a handout coming around, and as people are filing in, grab one of those. I'll be referring to that at one point in my talk. This is Defending the Truth Beautifully, Mock Trial. What page is this in your notebooks? 127 in your notebooks, if you'll give your attention to the material there, is in addition to the handout. And it looks like we're all going to be rattling around in this big room. Page 127. Oh, there we go.
I'm cyberstalking.
But it is morning, so I'll let you see some. You can see a movie. All right, my name is Chris Schlecht. Again, this is Defending the Truth Beautifully, Mock Trial. There is a handout that's being distributed, and I'll urge you to take a look at the notes on page 127 of the conference materials in your notebook. This is a rhetorical exercise. It's related to competition. It can be done in the classroom as a classroom exercise, if not competitively, which is a good place to start in order to sort of gear yourself up for competition, maybe to use it as a classroom exercise. And even if there's no one around to compete, it makes for a wonderful classroom exercise for reasons I hope will become evident to you. First, what is mock trial? It's a pseudo-trial. It's sort of a role-play trial, similar to putting on a play where the actors are in character in some sense, but that's what makes it mock rather than real trial. In mock trial, basically, teams are given a packet of materials upwards of, depending on, it varies from state to state, but teams are given a packet of materials, usually mock trial, and again, it varies from state to state, but in most states it's organized by the state bar associations, and there's a national level organization. They're coordinated into a national organization as well. So the home office, wherever it is, ours is in Boise because that's the state capital of Idaho, so they publish these case materials. And these case materials will be the basis for the arguments within the state of Idaho among all the teams in the state of Idaho in that year. These materials float around from year to year, and if you'll look, actually pushing you forward to 5 on the outline where I say online resources, the cases that were published nationally, that is to the champions of each state who will compete at nationals, I'm giving you the web links where you can actually go online, download the case materials. This year, the national competition was hosted in the state of Delaware. We were in Wilmington. The case materials were over 170-some pages. It was a very complicated case dealing with corporate law and a hostile takeover and flip-ins and shareholders' rights plans. And the plaintiff was seeking an injunction from the court against the defendant. And there was an odd terrorism connection as to whether or not the defendant was sponsoring international terrorism in its effort to purchase the port of Wilmington. And so we got corporate law, terrorism law, And it's very convoluted. Oftentimes, the better cases are designed to be highly convoluted, difficult, and challenging. In a given round, one team would represent the plaintiff, another team would represent the defense, and they will go against one another in the courtroom. And the plaintiff will call its own witnesses, and the witnesses actually role play a fictitious person. And the attorneys then will direct an examination, and then a student from the other team will cross-examine that student. It takes longer to explain than it does just to look at. That becomes quite evident if you just look at it. That's why I have this video here. And I'll be showing you that in a moment. But with my personal story with high school mock trial, I have been coaching mock trial since 1996 at Logos School. We have been state champions 10 times. Mock trial does not segregate schools by size or classification. We're one of the smallest schools in the state of Idaho that participates. We're up against the big schools in Boise, our little outback northern Idaho Moscow school, with graduating classes of 20 kids up against, say, Boise High School, whom we defeated this year toward our state championship again, that has graduating classes of hundreds and hundreds of kids. In Idaho's fairly little. We've enjoyed some success at the national competition. It's been a great honor for us to represent the state of Idaho and the entire legal community at Idaho and all high schools in the state of Idaho at the national competition. Where all state champions from many states come. We have competed against Guam, the Commonwealth of Northern Marianas Islands, Alaska, Hawaii, as well as representatives from many of the other states. In recent years, we've been recognized as, at the national level, one of the most prominent mock trial programs in the nation. We haven't won a national championship, but we've been very close to national contention, and the national competition organizers recognize us. Our program has received invitations to compete in special tournaments in New York City and in Colorado, in Chicago recently. We don't accept those invitations. We don't have funding, and mock trial needs an off-season. this past year, we had probably the highest honor in the history of our program at the Nationals competition at Wilmington. The entirety of the Delaware Supreme Court was on hand. The governor of Delaware was on hand. Many legal dignitaries from around the nation. Many courts of appeals judges. When you go to the national level competition, it's an interesting collection of legal professionals that gather to it to judge and participate in judging. A number of individual honors are handed out. Our team placed very high. Although it was low for us, we slipped back to 16th in a field of 42. But we've placed as high as 9, 11th, 12th. That's where we've been, which is among the top teams. But this year, we had one honoree who was singled out. It doesn't even happen every year that they would single out one honoree to be the top mock trial advocate in the entire country. Her name's Maggie Church. And you'll see her on video. She was something else. I could go on and on about my kids. It's just, I'm like that insufferable grandpa. I was pulling out his wallet, saying, "Hey, look at what my kids have done." It's exciting, and I love to talk mock trial. And so we'll see if we can get out of here by 3:30 this afternoon. I want to point out some advantages of mock trial and distinguish it from other forms of competitive oratory, and I think that will be helpful. First of all, competition does something to students and to student motivation that's hard to quantify, but its effects anecdotally I think are pretty evident to those who know kids. Our mock trial team, it's been highly successful. You know, we win state champions and championships, so on. Over time, it's become a very popular program at Logos School. Idaho, as with many states, allows each school to field two teams. This year, our varsity and JV teams had both eliminated every other school in the state, and we competed in the Supreme Court. It was Logos Varsity against Logos JV for the Idaho Championship. The future looks bright for our program, with given our JV kids. A third to a half of the eligible Logos High School students, grades 9 through 12, try out to be on this team. And we only take 8 kids per team, so we can just have 16 between our two teams. Our rhetoric teachers have reported, though, over the years that when we have kids in mock trial, and this is the competition side of it, when we have kids in mock trial, they participate in mock trial and attain a level of excellence. And when they're plugged into the rest of the classroom, what that tends to do in the whole environment and atmosphere and expectations of rhetorical quality for the non-mock trial kids, it's as though the waters come into the harbor and all the boats rise. I've learned that principle from a choir director, in fact, who advocated, and this makes common sense, but I hadn't thought of it before till he pointed it out to me. He said, you know, it's great to have big choirs with lots of people, but the ideal scenario is to have an elite choir that practices separately. They try out for it, and the most excellent voices are selected, and that might be, say, your touring choir. Then when the members of the elite choir are grouped into the broad choir, then that broad choir sounds so much better. Everyone else who's trying to come up to speed with learning music, they do so much faster. It's better for them. Does that make sense? You know, the water's coming in, all the boats rising. Anyway, I learned that principle from choir directors. Our rhetoric teachers report that's really been the case at Logos School with regard to our rhetoric courses, that we have kids participating in mock trial and the entire school culture of oratory and eloquence is affected by these teams that succeed the way they do. I prefer mock trial to competitive debate for many reasons, and I'm going to try to be brief about this, although I could take you till 5 o'clock. First of all, I want to say that I'm a big fan of competitive debate. Many of you are familiar with policy debate, Lincoln-Douglas debate, those familiar oratorical contests, and again, I'm a fan of those. I'm going to point out what I believe or perceive to be some faults or downsides, but I'm doing this by way of comparison, not as some sort of absolute complaint, so that those competitions are to be avoided at all costs. So don't take the wrong message from my criticisms, but it's a comparative evaluation. The American Forensics League, which governs the upper echelons of competition in debate, particularly policy debate, Lincoln-Douglas or value debate, has been around for many years. It's been around with us, you know, since perhaps our grandparents even. And it's popular with lots of wide involvement to such an extent that it's created its own enclave and culture. And in the last 10-15 years, many people, especially the old-timers, see that culture has created sort of an inbred system of rewards where certain practices, rhetorical practices, are rewarded within the context of the competition, that if you take them out of the competition and into a real-world context, is really not persuasive. This would be the speed talking, the truncated argumentation, I'll read a fine article. I have copies of these articles, too. I'll read just a passage from one of them that'll catch some of the criticisms by a fellow who's been involved in Lincoln-Douglas debate. Supposedly, it's Lincoln-Douglas is supposed to be immune to some of this that we see more in policy debate. But he says, and he's referring to Lincoln-Douglas here, he says, "To the extent that debaters do offer arguments about the resolution, they're often very poor arguments. little more than assertions claiming bad impacts to such hopelessly vague notions as societal welfare, democratic legitimacy, and rights trivialization. The prevalence and success of these sorts of arguments are a third symptom. This is, I'm highlighting one of many problems that he cites. Third symptom of Lincoln Douglas woes. Such phrases have become the unchallenged currency of Lincoln Douglas, and their vacuity is disguised in part by the elaborate chains of asserted empirical causations leading up to them. That is, action type A is asserted to cause effect B, it is asserted to cause effect C, is asserted to cause effect D, is asserted to cause a decrease in societal welfare. By making these causal chains sufficiently long, convoluted, and numerous, speakers deflect the scrutiny that might properly attach to any given link in any given chain. Speakers seem unaware that such arguments are often narrowly utilitarian, and they also seem unaware that there are powerful non-utilitarian arguments for this or that moral or political proposition, arguments which are often more intuitively plausible and less causally baroque than their utilitarian alternatives. Speakers rarely support their ambitious empirical assertions with the detailed empirical evidence that these assertions require. Any evidence that is presented is reduced after its first hurried reading to the author's last name, i.e., extend the Smith analysis. So, in other words, what he's saying here is that within the context of an affirmative constructive argument, you might have several separate and discrete arguments, perhaps seven or eight of them, each of which might take 45 seconds to exposit through the mechanism of speed talking. 45 seconds. It's kind of like asking Barack Obama or John McCain, what's your policy in Iraq? And he gives you a 30-second answer, and people think that that's meaningful. That just shows the level of our discourse here. But then later on in the debate is that 45-second discrete point is interacted with, it becomes the Smith analysis. Not really engaged and interacted with, but just carried forward in the flow chart. That's the sort of thing he's describing. He says, its content and quality are rarely scrutinized. Many students, coaches, and judges seem to believe that such arguments are just what Lincoln Douglas is supposed to be about, and they debate, coach, and judge accordingly. Again, the fast talking. There are other criticisms. I believe that the problem has to do with the culture itself and its own success. It's a competitive debate is a product and a problem of its own success, where it has, again, created its own system of awards. One of the signs of a problem is that you need to be a trained, experienced debater to be a debate judge, even to follow the arguments. By contrast to mock trial, it's run by bar associations, and the people involved are trial attorneys. And it's my sense, this is my own cultural observation, but it's my sense that one of the last bastions of real oratory in the country is the courtroom. One of the last places in our society today where you can see real oratory, and by real oratory, what I mean is real, meaningful decisions that matter being affected by oratory. There are plenty of places in our society where real, meaningful decisions are made, not just in the courtroom, but those decisions being made by how something is presented and packaged, an organization of facts, bring them together before reasonable people who might not be specialists in the matter, and the issue does matter, and the decision is based on that kind of enterprise, the courtroom is one of the last places in our society where I believe that that still abides. And, of course, I think certain aspects of societal disintegration in our jury system, that might fade away. But trial attorneys know the real world and real world persuasion. Hollywood doesn't. If you were a real juror making a real decision, then what you see lawyers doing in Hollywood on the TV sorts of things, you would really be turned off. If you're really deciding whether or not this corporation needs to have its pockets dug into by the plaintiff, and you're really going to decide that, or whether this guy needs to be executed or sent up the river, and you're the juror, A lot of things that you see on television are not going to affect you the way that the TV audience that seeks to be entertained is going to be affected, right? So one of the great protections of mock trial, I think, just has to do with the culture and where it comes from and what rewards it. If it doesn't make sense to intelligent, normal, non-specialist people, then it's not persuasive. And I think that the culture then, therefore, is quite a bit different in mock trial. So it's real-world oratory, real persuasion. And I can go on and talk about policy debates and the foibles of policy debate in Lincoln Douglas, but I won't develop that any further. What I'd like to do at this point, then, is I've got some practical suggestions that I'll make, but I want to give a little time to just show you what it looks like. This is... Let's see what I'm going to show you. My computer is blocked out. Is from the state championship round. A competition takes about 2 hours, so this is severely excerpted, and you're not going to be able to. I've tried to use excerpts from different points of the trial that continue a certain thread of analysis. There are many other threads of analysis that are taking place that I've edited out. And so anyway, understand that. This is taking place in the Idaho Supreme Court. The presiding judge is the Chief Justice of the state of Idaho. The case is a criminal case. Sometimes we argue civil cases, as we did for nationals. It's a criminal case where the defendant has been charged with stalking by means of electronic communication or cyber stalking, which takes place on an online chat room. So that's the nature of the case here. My son helped me edit this.
We're on the record here today in the state of Idaho versus Kinsley Williams, presiding. Today is, of course, myself, Judge Horton, seated to my right in his eighth time sitting as a finals in this competition. Judge is Russ Heller, and to my left is Vice Chief Justice of the Idaho Supreme Court, Roger Burdick. We will be sitting as your judge and jury here today.
Testimony will show that Shockwave used the internet to post messages directed at Jamie, messages that were designed to put Jamie in a state of fear. Shockwave began his experiment on May 7th, and it ended on May 12th, 2007. By that time, Jamie Anderson was devastated. She couldn't eat, she couldn't sleep, and she could barely go outside because of this fear that Shockwave had created through his experiment. Your Honor, counsel, members of the jury, Shockwave and Survive's real name is Kinsley Williams, the defendant who is now being charged with the criminal offense of cyberstalking. My co-counsel and I represent the state of Idaho, and it is our task to prove to you that the defendant knowingly placed Jamie Anderson in reasonable apprehension of immediate or future bodily harm, and did so by means of electronic communication. We will present three witnesses to you today. First, we will call Jamie Anderson. Jamie will tell you what it was like to be the victim of Shockwave's experiment.
Okay, I'm going to pause here and tell you that what you're about to see is not scripted. It's the witness statements that the kids are given. It's very much like what a real attorney is given. The statement might be taken by the police officer, an investigating officer, and it's part of the discovery and gathering. And from this, they need to organize an examination. The way we strategize which order we call the witnesses is something that we need to invent. Some teams script. They tend not to reach the higher echelons of competition. You need to roll with the punches. There are rulings on evidence. Rulings can go either way. You need to argue rules of evidence, the admissibility of things. But again, what you're about to see is not really scripted. It's highly prepared, but it can't be scripted because it can go any way you can imagine. You're going to see a series of direct examinations. I'm featuring our eight, the champion team's case, too. You're not going to see the presentation of the other side, but I wanted to let you know, be aware of that.
Statement call its first witness.
The state calls Jamie Anderson to the stand.
So this is the victim. We called her first. and the name might be one familiar to ACCS people.
Your Honor, may I proceed? Could you please state your name and spell the last for the court?
Jamie Anderson, A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N.
And what was your occupation in May of last year?
I was a sophomore at Idaho State University.
And when did this happen?
This happened during May of last year. I received the first comment on Monday, May 7th, and then it kept coming. I got another on the 10th, and then the 11th, and the 12th.
Now let's talk about what you received on each of those days. The first date you mentioned was the 7th. What was posted that day?
This was a comment from Survive, and this person said, "Jam."
Objection, Your Honor, this is hearsay.
Your Honor, may I respond?
You may.
The statements are not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. At issue in this case is whether Kinsley Williams harassed Jamie or transmitted a threat to Jamie. We are not interested in whether Kinsley meant what he said or whether he intended to follow through with the threat. We are not interested in whether the statements are true. We only need to prove that the statements were made.
Would you like to respond?
Yes, Your Honor. If I understand counsel's way of directing this examination, I believe that counsel is using the truth of these statements to lay foundation for what will continue later.
This poor guy didn't know what hit him.
You concur to court rule of objection. The objection will be overruled. You may continue with your examination.
It's a highly technical analysis of the hearsay rule. I don't know if you followed that, but it was a wonderful. You don't know when they're going to object. You don't know what they're going to object to. Sometimes judges rule in cockeyed ways to see what you're going to do to respond to it. You don't know the direction that you can take your own exam or what you're going to be able to get in. Again, so that's an illustration of what's going on here.
Now, again, Jamie, what was posted on the 7th?
Survive said, "Jams in the window. Exercise all you want, my friend. You won't be able to run fast enough."
Now, why did this concern you?
I had been exercising in my window just the night before, and this person was obviously talking about me, Jam, and it just creeped me out to think that somebody was out there looking at me through my window.
The next date you've mentioned was the 10th. What was posted that day?
Shockwave posted on that day, and they said, "Speaking of color, Jammin's been seen wearing school colors all week. Think blood won't show on those dark colors."
Why did this upset you?
I had been wearing school colors all week. I had been wearing orange and black for work at the bookstore, and this person was talking about my clothes being bloody, and I thought that they might attack me at some time.
Please state your name and spell the last for the court.
Casey Wallner, W-A-L-L-N-E-R.
How do you know Jamie Anderson?
Briefly, what I, of course, passed over a lot more testimony from that first witness who was the victim, but then she was cross-examined by the other side. In these witness statements, there are always things that are unfavorable to your own side. How do you deal with those? There's rhetorical issues of presentation. You need to own up to them so as not to sound too defensive. You need to, and anyway, the direction of cross-examination is artful, and witnesses need to be very sharp in how they present as well. Again, they can't script how they're going to respond to answers on cross-examination. Okay.
Very well. She's my best friend.
By the way, in this, Maggie Church is the best mock trial student in the country this year. She's an attorney when we represent the defense side, and boy, you're not going to see her as an attorney, but she's...
I've known her since high school, and now she's my roommate at ISU.
And do you know Kinsley Williams?
I know Kinsley Williams really just in passing. I know that he lives in our dorm and that he's a little bit intense, but other than that, I hardly know him.
Now, Jamie just talked about messages that she saw in the chat room that had scared her. I'm going to ask you some questions about those. Did you see these messages?
I did. I saw every single one of the posts.
And who were they made by?
They were made by the usernames Shockwave and Survive2004.
When was the first message that Jamie received?
Jamie received the first post on Monday, May 7th.
What did this post say?
This post said, "Exercise all you want, my jammin' friend. You won't be able to run fast enough."
How did you react to finding out that someone was watching Jamie in her window?
Well, I was scared for both myself and Jamie. Someone was telling us that they could see us, that they could look in at our window and watch what we were doing. I mean, we're two college girls, and someone out there was being a peeping Tom looking in at our window, and it did scare both of us.
Objection, Your Honor. This is Meriton.
Your response.
Your Honor, she's still answering the question within the scope, or answering my question within the scope of my question.
The objection will be overruled. You may continue.
What was Jamie's reaction to finding out that someone was watching her in the window?
Well, she was scared. Like I said, we thought some peeping Tom was out there watching her exercise.
Now, did you and Jamie do anything after you saw this first message?
No, we didn't. We weren't sure exactly what was going on, and we didn't want to do anything rash.
So we'll take you forward here for the sake of time through this witness and through these excerpts here. Then here's the investigating officer. This attorney is a very important sophomore on our team. Let me see. Okay, let's catch up here. Go.
State your name and spell the last for the court.
Andrew Hopp, H-O-P-P.
What's your occupation, Mr. Hopp?
I'm an Idaho State Police Detective.
And were you acting in this capacity during May of 2007?
Yes, sir, I was. I actually became involved in this case during...
Well, again, Officer Hopp, which comments did Kinsley admit to making on the chat room?
There were numerous comments on both the 11th and the 12th of May that Kinsley admitted to.
And where were these comments sent from?
All of the comments that Kinsley said he posted came from a computer located in a small, out-of-the-way room at the end of a hallway on the ground floor of East Hall, Kinsley's dormitory.
Now, first, I want to talk about the comments on the 11th. What comments on this date did Kinsley admit making?
There were three comments on the 11th that Kinsley admitted to that drew my attention in particular. The first one said, "Wonder if anyone our age would handle this situation well. It would be interesting to try and recreate the atmosphere." The next comment said, "It would be amazing to study pain and suffering. Doctors must do it all the time. Long-term effects of suffering could produce some interesting data. Volunteers, hey Jam, you still here?" And then finally, Kinsley posted a comment that said, "Jam is full of fear, would make a great experiment."
So Officer Hopp, why did these comments draw your attention?
Well, these comments were important because here, Kinsley Williams stated directly in the chat room,
Your Honor, may I respond?
You may.
Officer Hopp interviewed Kinsley Williams, and Kinsley Williams admitted to posting these comments.
As long as your questioning restricts itself to the questioning that the accused has admitted making, the objection will be overruled to the extent that you're attempting or maybe interpreted as attempting to bring in every statement attributed to Shockwave or Survive. Future objections will be sustained. You may continue.
Again, Officer Hopp, why did these three comments draw your attention particularly?
These comments, as I was saying, were important because Kinsley stated directly in the chat room that he was interested in pain and suffering and researching fear. And then he requested for volunteers right before posting.
Objection, Your Honor, speculation as to what Shockwave meant by the comment.
Your Honor, may I respond?
You may.
Officer Hopp is testifying to the content of the posts. He is not testifying to the intent or meaning behind the posts.
Your reply.
Your Honor, I stand on my objection.
Overruled. The objection's overruled.
As I was saying, right after Kinsley requested for volunteers, he said, "Hey, Jam, you still here?" And then a further post even said that Jam would make a great experiment.
Now, those were the posts that Kinsley admitted making. Were there any from his usernames on the 11th that he denies making?
Yes, sir.
There was one post that Kinsley denied. This post said, "Jammin' is back. Time is running out, my jammin' friend. Maybe we can meet in the alley.
And when was this post made?
This post was made at 3:36 p.m. on the 11th.
And when was it made relative to the posts Kinsley told you he did make?
This post actually came only 20 minutes after the last post that Kinsley admitted to.
Which was the last post that Kinsley admitted to?
This was the post about Jam being an experiment.
Now, which username did Kinsley use when he posted the comment, Jam would make a great experiment?
Kinsley had been using his Shockwave username.
And what username did this post about meeting in the alley come under?
This also came from Kinsley's Shockwave username.
So did Kinsley log out between these two posts?
No, sir. There was no sign in the chat room that he had done so.
And where were these two posts sent from?
Both of these posts came from the East Hall computer.
Okay, now you're going to see a very cross-examination of a very feisty defendant, Kinsley Williams. This is a battle that develops here in the Supreme Court chamber.
It is.
And you just testified that you are interested, that pain and suffering interests you, correct?
I just testified to that. That's not anywhere in that post, ma'am.
Just a while ago, Mr. Williams, you testified that it would be interesting to study pain and suffering, correct?
Previous victims' testimonies of that, yes.
Yes, and the next post that Shockwave makes on the chat room on May 11th is about how it would be interesting to study the pain and suffering of someone under fear, correct?
Correct.
Now, you admit to making that statement, don't you?
Oh, yes.
You admit to saying that long-term effect of suffering could produce some interesting data. Volunteers, hey, Jam, you still here. You said that, correct?
Correct.
So after you said that long-term effect of suffering could produce some interesting data, you asked for volunteers.
I wasn't asking for volunteers to this experiment. I don't know what you're accusing me of, but that's not true.
Your Honor, I ask that you instruct the witness to answer my question.
If you would please listen carefully to the question that was presented to you and answer the question that was directed to you, Mr. Williams, you may continue with your examination.
Now, Mr. Williams, this is very easy. On the chat room, you said it would be interesting to study long-term effects of pain and suffering. It could produce some interesting data. You said that, didn't you?
I did.
And then right after you said that, you said volunteers, didn't you?
Yes, I said volunteers. I was asking if anybody had anything to volunteer to this discussion.
You did say volunteers, Mr. Williams, correct?
Yes.
And then after you said volunteers, you said, hey, Jam, you still here, correct?
Correct.
Now, isn't it true that Jamie's nickname is Jam?
Yes.
And isn't it true that you yelled the Jam at Jamie as she was leaving the student? Mr. Williams, was 5 minutes later, a post was made by Shockwave that you deny. Correct.
I did not. I did not make that post.
You did not say, Jamin, can you come out of the second floor roost and play?
I said no such
but
thing.
But this was made by the same username Shockwave, correct?
Correct.
The same username that you admit to posting on 5 minutes previously.
Correct.
And the statement that you admit you made from a computer in East Hall, correct?
In East Hall, yes.
And Officer Hopp just testified that this statement 5 minutes later after one that you admit came from the same computer at East Hall, correct?
Yes.
Chat room does not show that you logged off in between these two statements, does it?
Chat room doesn't show anything between these two statements, so yes, it doesn't show me logging off.
So it doesn't show you logging off. Now, Mr. Williams, you would have us believe that someone is impersonating you on the chat room, correct?
That is what happened. That's the only reasonable explanation for it.
That's your explanation for it. So you would have us believe that someone is following you around and posting on the chat room under your usernames, correct?
And they're still out there. I'm in here. I don't see the purpose of this.
Mr. Williams, your testimony is that someone is following you around and posting under your username, correct?
I don't know if they're following me around. I don't know who this person is.
But they are posting under your username. That's your story.
That's for sure.
So basically, Mr. Williams, you're the one who's being stalked here, correct?
Exactly.
And you're the victim, not Jamie Anderson.
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have no further questions.
Thank you. Redirect.
Yes, Your Honor.
I wouldn't want to be cross-examined by Chantel either.
Listen to more posts made by Shockwave in the chat room. Long-term effect of pain and suffering could produce some interesting data. Would be amazing to study long-term effect of pain and suffering.
Volunteers? Hey, Jam, you still here? Jam is full of fear. Would make a great experiment. Well, we must prove to you today that Kinsley Williams cyberstalked Jamie Anderson. Now, a person commits cyberstalking when he or she knowingly and on two separate occasions without lawful justification harasses a person through the use of electronic communication. Kinsley Williams harassed Jamie Anderson. Harass means to engage in knowing and a willful course of conduct directed at a specific person that alarms that person, that terrorizes that person, and that torments them. Kinsley Williams made statements in the chat room that made Jamie fear for her life. Kinsley knew that Jamie's username was Jammin' at ISU. Kinsley's username has survived 2004 in Shockwave. There's no reasonable explanation, no evidence to provide that we have here to show that he did not post under these usernames in the chat room. Today, we have shown you beyond a reasonable doubt that on more than two occasions, Kinsley Williams harassed Jamie Anderson. He alarmed her, he tormented her, he terrorized her. But Jamie's reaction was reasonable. Her apprehension was reasonable, and that is why we ask you to find Kinsley Williams guilty of cyberstalking. Thank you.
Thank you. And for the defense.
So there you have a sampling of a certain thread running through the plaintiff's case. And I skipped over a whole lot, and especially a lot of the detailed analysis from the police officer and the detailed analysis in that closing statement and rebutting the other side. But hopefully that gives you a sense of the complexion of how this shapes up. Chantel's cross-examination of the defendant was against one of the best witnesses that we had to deal with in the entire state trial was one of the deciding factors. Mock trial is judged not by the verdict, although the judges found in favor of the prosecution in this case. Sometimes the case materials naturally lend themselves on legal merits to favor one side or the other. As much as you try to design a case, as you put it to trial, sometimes that's just what happens. And so winning the case on legal merits is not what dictates competition advancement. Although in many states they will tell you on the legal merits what they believe to be the finding, but competition advancement has to do with judging the presentation, how well did the students work with what they were handed, given the case materials as they are. And there are different categories in the judging. And if you get online with the case materials, you'll see what the judging forms look like. There are separate categories for opening statement, each witness testimony, direct cross-examination have their own categories on the judging sheets. And so that's how competition advancement works, based on that rather than on the legal outcome of the case. And when it gets to the higher levels of competition, we've had this happen many times where just about every round there's a verdict in favor of the plaintiff because it's well presented at the higher levels of competition, and that's just kind of how the case materials shape up. Although our kids have learned, this happened in Idaho a couple years ago, where every time we went up, the legal merits went with whichever side we were presenting, which teaches kids some interesting things about American law. And that's really how it works. How things are presented and packaged in the courtroom do weigh into the decision that jurors will make, and that's true. So when Logos presents a plaintiff side, then there's a finding for the plaintiff. We present on the defense side, and the jury's defined for the defense, and our kids hopefully don't turn cynical about that. But there's some reality there. I want to speak briefly to, because this gets into detail about how to form a team and how to do this. I say briefly because there's no end to the detail this is going into. It's a little bit of, you ask how to coach mock trial, that's a little bit like asking a basketball coach how to coach basketball to people who are unfamiliar with basketball in an hour. I find that sort of comical. There's a lot that goes into coaching mock trial. But so I want to give you some broad outline approaches and suggestions. Let's see. I suggest you build a team out of a rhetoric class. Perhaps the rhetoric class could be, and performance in a rhetoric class could be the basis for your selection of team members. Some of the schools are of such a size that the entire rhetoric class might be the entire team. And that's just fine. Let's see. But Roman numeral two, starting into mock trial, depending on which state you're in, I would urge you to contact the coordinator for your state. These people tend to be very philanthropic with their time and energies, and are very excited when an educator from who might be thinking about bringing on a new mock trial team into the system. They can put you into contact with others who might be close in your area who can help you out. And so that's really the first place to start. There's some variation from state to state, but the Nationals website, which is website A, actually has a link to identify the state coordinators in your given states. It's usually someone related to the Bar Association. So that's the first place to go. Read through some of the cases I've given you online. If you can find more videos just to get a grasp of how mock trial works, that's a great orientation. If you're just starting from scratch, do that kind of thing. And then attend a competition. It's best to attend a competition and field a team, be willing to get whacked. That's how, first season you field a basketball team, what's going to happen? You're going to lose. But you have a... Don't be discouraged about that. That's the growing pains when you're venturing into new territory. So don't worry about that. So attend a competition if at all you can. It's been a great honor for us. Some people have, as we travel, when we go to nationals, some ACCS people have come to watch and root on Idaho from... You know, we had some people ACCS people back east. It was a great delight to have them come into the courtrooms in Wilmington, because here we are way out in Delaware, and we're from Idaho, and some friendly faces. It was great. So, and that's what they were doing. They were heeding my advice, attending competition, wanted to see what mock trial's like. And if you can attend the national level competition, then you're going to really learn a lot of good lessons, because the level of competition, they're all champions who are competing there, and it's really quite a different level, I would say. I should add that we have placed ahead of Texas. I count one of our greatest mock trial victories back in 2006 when we actually competed. This was in the competed against the Texas state champion. To be the Texas state champion, you have to rise to the top of about 500 or 600 mock trial teams. And we finally faced them head-to-head, and we actually beat them. I count that as our greatest competition round accomplishment, beating Texas. Little Idaho beats it. out goes the wallet and pointing to the pictures. I'm pathetic and insufferable. I'll talk about tryouts briefly. If you want to conduct a tryout, I would urge you to try to find a very simple case, and then let the kids review the case, and give them a little mock trial orientation in, say, a lunch meeting. You want to try out for the team? Well, here's kind of how it works. Maybe show them a video of how it works. They're not going to know the rules of evidence. They're not going to know the law, and that's fine. But show them how it works, and then choose out of the witnesses. Just say, if you want to try out to be an attorney, then prepare a direct of this witness and a cross of the same witness. If you want to try out to be a witness, then come prepared to role play that witness. And then you can see how the kids do. The kids are going to do all kinds of things stylistically that don't conform to how courtroom, some of the protocols of the courtroom. And you have to overlook that, because they haven't coached on that. There are courtroom protocols, but what I find most telling and revealing is as we conduct tryouts, then I'll give the participants feedback and then say, okay, come back and do that again. Now take your notes away and do it. And those are the sorts of things I do. And the most important quality is to see how they respond, how they learn, have they learned from the feedback that I've given the previous person, and as their improvement, can they listen and follow and then implement? And those are the qualities that I look for. Not necessarily the slickest presentation out of the starting blocks, but rather their capacity to improve after hearing the feedback. I've done this before. Kids come to tryouts, and they'll start working through it, and they're working. They've got this in their notes, and that's fine. You know, they're using their notes. But when I'm trying to choose between two kids, you know, call one kid up, and he'll start going through it, and then I'll sneak up to the podium and snatch his notes and say, "You got to keep going, man." See what he does. So how do they respond to the unforeseen and the adverse? That's what the sort of things that I do in tryouts. Team coaching, then. You need an attorney, particularly if you have one who's experienced in courtroom advocacy. If you've got a trial lawyer in your school orbit, then involve that person. You're going to need some help in coaching on law, the rules of evidence. In particular, I showed for you a very nuanced hearsay analysis. A lot of times these cases have evidentiary nuances built in, designed so that there will be a war over evidence in the courtroom. They design the cases that way, and the kids need to be informed about that. And that takes a lot of coaching, lots of work with evidence. One of the reasons why you heard a lot of memorized testimony about Kinsley Williams postings, that's because we in our legal analysis believed that the postings themselves or the transcript of the chat room was hearsay, and we didn't attempt to admit it into evidence for that reason. There's a hearsay. There are plenty of arguments to try to argue that it is, whether it conforms to the business records exception and things like that, and we don't believe it's a business record nor conduct of regular conducted activity, therefore inadmissible. And kids who depended for their case upon entering those chat room transcripts, when they confronted our defense, oftentimes that was omitted from evidence, and they were left hamstrung without their exhibit that they needed to get those chat room posts in. So anyway, you need an attorney to help you out with some of that kind of stuff. So get an attorney, and I've commented on rules of evidence then and developing a case. If you look to the next page, and then I've got the website. Those are resources for you to look to, but look to the next page, the practice schedule. This is the practice schedule that I adopted. When we go to nationals, of course, the nationals cases that are published to the state champion participants are far more convoluted and nuanced and complicated. They're just hard. And then you only have 5 or 6 weeks to prepare, which is downright almost impossible. And I tell the kids, if we're state champions and we're going to nationals, then wipe April off the map. And that's the case. But to prepare for a state-level competition when you have more time, you can take this. This is just my advice, the way I go about it for team preparation. Once the case materials are published, you'll have several months to work on the case, and then you compete. It's unlike athletics, where you have a season of games, and then after the second game, you can say, "Oh, we need to work on this, we need to work on that," and then the third game, more practice. It's more like a play in the sense of, and this is like debate competitions, where you work and work and you prepare, and then you go to a competition and you're either eliminated and done, or you move on. Okay, so there's a lot hanging on every round of competition. And, you know, we go to regionals. Most of the teams are done after regionals, except for those that qualify to state. And then the state champion, of course, everyone is eliminated except the one team representing that state and so on. And then you're given a whole new case, and life is crazy. But the sequence, while the timeline is a little contracted because this is a nationals preparation schedule, the sequence, this is what I advise. So, the case is published, and And so the coaches need to assign, okay, who's playing attorney, who's playing witnesses, which witness roles. I mean, you don't know what the witnesses' roles are, even whether it's criminal or civil case, until the case material is published. So you read through it, the coaches need to confer and say, okay, you're going to be this witness, you're going to do the examination of this witness direct, you're going to be crossing that witness, you're going to be... So there's a lot of role assignments then that you need to settle, and settle that very quickly so that the kids know what their role is, they can get to work in their role in the case. So the onus is on the coach right out of the starting blocks. And then develop a legal theory. These cases are convoluted, confusing. There's always red herrings, things that are inadmissible, things that are irrelevant, that are in all kinds of irrelevant material in these cases, in the witness statements. You need to be able to sift through that. Develop a legal theory of the case. And I say begin with the plaintiff. Work on the plaintiff's case first. And you work on the plaintiff's case first because of the nature of the burden of proof. The duty of the defense, whether in a criminal case when the burden of proof is beyond reasonable doubt or a civil case where the burden of proof is preponderance of the evidence, there's a burden on the plaintiff and the defendant. It's hard to develop a legal theory for the defendant until you've really kind of wrapped your tentacles around the plaintiff's side. So I just say focus on the plaintiff. Focus and, you know, break it down. And so that's the breakdown. Focus on the plaintiff. And then you can move to the defense. We usually spend 3 or 4 weeks actually on the plaintiff's side. And the defense, we spend much less time preparing usually because a lot of the heavy lifting has been done with regard to the issues, the relevant issues in the case when we prepare the plaintiff's case. And then some of the categories that the defense needs to deal with, you've kind of settled once you understand the plaintiff's case. Of course, there are different theories of the case that you can encounter in the trials. Anyway, so you develop the defense case, and then I say tighten up nuances. The last thing you prepare are opening statements and closing arguments. The opening statements are really the only thing that is going to be memorized first thing out of the starting blocks. You don't have anything really to react to. But you don't know what you're going to be saying in the opening statement until you really have the whole thing mapped out. So that's why openings and closings come last in your preparations. When you focus on closings, and opening is actually one of the last things we do, as you start to develop the closing arguments, a lot of times you're going to notice, oh, these are things we need to highlight, and then you wind up changing the witness examinations all the time because, if this is the argument we need to make, then we need to rhetorically underscore this better from this witness or that. Boy, and on cross-examination, you need to get the defendant saying this in order for us to claim that in our closing. And so we always wind up rehashing the witness exams after that development of the closing. And so that's the way it proceeds, kind of the sequence of preparation. And then the handout is not something that I wanted to walk through. I just prepared that for this. I hope it's self-evident to you, different things to work on and to concentrate on when we're working. I think that I mentioned Maggie Church, for example. I think one of the things that impressed the judges at Nationals with her, she was in our Nationals case, she was the plaintiff's, it was a civil case, she was the plaintiff's attorney. She delivered closing arguments, but she called the first witness. And so the plaintiff's opening always goes first, then the defense's opening. And I remember this worked so wonderfully against Kentucky especially. It was eye-popping. And Kentucky had a fantastic opening statement. And then Maggie, she's the plaintiff. She calls the first witness, so it's our team's witness that she's directing. And she walked through the rhetorical and argumentative points from Kentucky's opening as charting the course in her direct examination. And you could see the defense's case being directly engaged. She took some of the same phrases, and she said, Now, counsel said this in their opening, and here's my question for you. Again, that's not scripted. You can't script that, and that's a sort of... So even in a direct examination, she's working with her own witness. That's a... That's kind of high octane varsity level. It's very difficult to execute well. You're kind of out there on the skinny branches. But if you can get to that level, that's really fun engagement. Of course, it almost looks scripted, though, how smooth she was. He should have been there. So, okay. Well, thank you very much. I think our time is out, but I'm not going to be disappearing, so I'd be more than happy to take your questions. I don't think here at the podium, but you can come up here. I'll dismiss you. And I have several copies of those articles that I was citing about Lincoln-Douglas debate, if you'd like to grab those. So thank you very much.
And then it's live.